Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome, Sarah.
Hey, Amy. Good to be here.
Also with us is a politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer.
Welcome. Good morning.
Hi. And Danny Eldridge, a reporter for Hanna News Service. Welcome, Danny.
Good to be here.
So, in preparation for his new role as vice president, Ohio's own Senator J.D. Vance resigned from the Senate last week. So that paves the way for Governor DeWine to finally pick his successor. Why has he not picked yet, Jeremy?
It's a great question. And there's been a lot of speculation about who he's going to pick. It looks like the consensus, at least among people around Capitol Square, is that he's going to pick John Husted. Of course, Husted and DeWine themselves have been pretty tight-lipped about that. And everyone's just now waiting to see when the formal announcement's going to come. But I think a lot of people would be, including us, would be very surprised if it wasn't John Husted.
And Sarah, you were saying before we came on air that you would be surprised if there's not some pomp and circumstance, maybe a press conference, or do you think he'll be quiet about this?
No, I have to imagine there's going to be a press conference. Governor DeWine has a lot of press conferences, honestly, and this is a huge announcement. I mean, when you think about a Senate seat, it's right up there. Ohio only gets two U.S. senators like everybody else. And, you know, this is not some big U.S. Senate election. It's an audience of one. Governor DeWine is appointing this person. And this person realistically will be likely running for the seat again in future years. So this is a really, really big decision. DeWine has characterized it as one of the biggest decisions he's going to make as governor, which I think is obviously why this has been so drawn out. I mean, he's not just been thinking about this since Trump and Vance were elected. He's been thinking about this since July when J.D. Vance was named mm-hmm. as Trump's VP pick.
Yeah, and Danny, Husted emerged as the front runner when DeWine and Husted flew to Mar-a-Lago last month to visit with President-elect Donald Trump. Was Husted on your radar for this job before that visit?
I mean, yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he's obviously someone who's been a legislator. He was Speaker of the House. He has experience. He's won statewide elections before, so he checks those boxes. The only reason people thought he might not pick him was that he was also seen as a leading candidate for governor. But because Dave Yost has made pretty clear that he's going to run, the U.S. Senate seat would be more of a sure thing running against Dave Yost. You know, it's hard to tell who would win between John Husted and Dave Yost in a primary.
And it seems like it could be, you know, a wider primary field than that when you've had these more recent kind of firebrand conservatives in Trump's orbit, like Vivek Ramaswamy. He obviously made a run for president and has been in Trump's circle. He's going to be serving as in the administration on the Department of Government Efficiency, but that role like conveniently ends in like early 2026, which is right around the time that Vivek might be running for governor. So there, of course, you know, whoever's going to succeed DeWine is like that other big chess piece in this whole conversation. And I think in addition to Dave Yost, there are a lot of Republican possibilities who are looking to step up in 2026.
Well, and Jeremy, we were talking before the show started, and it hadn't even occurred to me that if John Husted becomes senator, we need a new lieutenant governor.
We need a new lieutenant governor for the last 2 years of Mike DeWine's term. There's been a couple of names floated about. One is Lydia Mihalik, who's the head of Department of Development in DeWine's administration. She's a former mayor of Findlay. She was discussed in 2018 as a possible running mate for DeWine. Another person is State Senator Teresa Gavarone of Wood County around Bowling Green. And so, with Republican dominance over Ohio, when a position opens up like this, this high, there's this musical chairs game.
It's like, whose turn is it?
And there's not a lot of openings. There's a lot of Republicans, not a lot of openings. Yeah. And when there is an opening, especially at these high of levels, there's usually, you know, a number of people who try to go for it because there's just a, you know, the supply outweighs the demand.
Well, and I would also say that whoever DeWine picks to be the new lieutenant governor for the next 2 years would probably want to run for governor.
Not
right?
necessarily.
No?
I mean, you could have someone who is preparing to run statewide in 2026 for something else, and it gives them name recognition. I don't think many people know who Lydia Mihalik is, mm-hmm. but being lieutenant governor would give her a statewide platform to prepare to run for some down-ticket office. Now, I have no intel, but I'm using her just as an example to say that there's other reasons that people could benefit from being lieutenant governor than just planning to run for governor themselves.
And Danny, Husted does not come without baggage. You know, DeWine and Husted face no official charges related to the House Bill 6 bailout bill. But there are text messages that were made public as a part of the investigation. There is a little bit of DeWine and Husted in there. Do you think that that could hurt his chances for governor, but maybe doesn't, or senator?
I mean, it's possible, but you know, that scandal, you know, hasn't stopped Republicans from winning everything the last election. So I don't really, now that it's even further in the rearview mirror, I'm not really sure that it's going to affect elections going forward. I mean, if some bombshell drops and, you know, there's some kind of smoking gun, then that's one thing. But it just, as far as it is right now, I would be surprised if it had any effect.
And Sarah, no matter who is picked, honestly, if it's Husted or some name that comes out of nowhere, we're going to have a freshman senator, Bernie Moreno, and then we're going to have another senator who's brand new. Either way, Ohio will have two brand new senators. So what will that inexperience do for Ohio? Is that going to hurt Ohio?
Yeah, you know, I asked Senator Moreno about this very thing when he was Senator-elect Moreno like a month or two ago, because of course now he's technically the senior senator from Ohio because there's no one else in the Senate for Ohio right now.
Right.
It's just
Moreno. He's had the job like a few days longer, so yeah.
Exactly. Moreno said he's going to lean into the policy areas that matter for him, what he's coming in with his experience, like, for example, the auto industry. And I do think there is some benefit to the fact that Ohio's two U.S. senators are both Republicans. They're both going to be well-liked by Trump because, of course, Trump has had a role in the decision-making, I'm sure, as to who DeWine is going to appoint. But that being said, you are going from a scenario where the Senate, like you said, is based in part on seniority. And you're going from a couple of years ago where you had Rob Portman and Sherrod Brown to longtime statesmen, to people who are going to be a lot more unfamiliar with federal office. So, I mean, it's tough to say right now what that means, but the Senate is based a lot on seniority.
Yeah, Jeremy, what do you think? Because committee assignments in the Senate are based on seniority, and I think that whoever DeWine picks is going to get the lowest level committee assignments now.
That's true. At the same time, whoever comes in, certainly Bernie Moreno will come in with strong ties to the White House. Not just political ties, but, you know, I mean, Donald Trump was at Bernie Moreno's daughter's wedding. So they have, so there will be some political influence, even though, as you say, seniority does matter in the Senate. And so that's not something to take lightly. But there's other ways to exercise power, too, for both Moreno and whoever takes the side in the Senate.
Should I make you all guess, when is DeWine going to do this announcement? Today, while we're on the air, or
hopefully not on the air.
Today, tomorrow, by Friday?
I have to imagine it's going to be by midweek. I don't know how long he wants to drag this out. I mean, again, I'm not going on any information except my own opinion.
Except that we're all like, come on, let's just move on.
You're abutting a long weekend because you've got a 3-day weekend with MLK Junior Day. You've got the inauguration on Monday the 20th, and you've got the big Ohio
and
State games.
There's a lot going on the 20th. Yeah.
I mean, this is obviously, the clock is ticking regardless. Like, he has to appoint someone, but what DeWine was waiting for and what he's been saying he was waiting for was Vance's resignation letter. He has that now. So I have to imagine he's going to make it sooner rather than later.
It was funny that Vance tweeted recently that he said, quote, hopefully everyone's cool with me skipping the inauguration so I can go to the national title game.
I saw that. So he wants to go cheer on Ohio State. He's like, do you have to go to your own inauguration?
I mean, priorities, right?
Probably should be at the inauguration. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Danny Eldridge for the Hannah News Service, and Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. So the other news that happened is we're just under two years out from the 2026 general election, in which we will have a new governor because DeWine is term limited. And Dr. Amy Acton, known to many as the former director of the Ohio Department of Health, who led us through the beginning of the pandemic, announced her intention to run as a Democrat. Now, Jeremy, she filed and announced ahead of any other Democratic candidate. So what do we know about her motivation to run?
I don't think it's a coincidence she decided to get out early. This is a race that the Republican is going to go in favored, like whatever Republican, like generic Republican, the Republican nominee, whoever it is, will almost certainly be favored over the Democratic nominee, whoever it is. So Amy Acton, her supporters see her and hope that she runs as a non-traditional candidate because they see that if the Democrats are going to win, they need someone who's not just running a traditional campaign. And by that, they mean they hope that they see Amy Acton as almost like a transformational, inspirational candidate along the lines of Barack Obama or Dick Celeste, who was elected Ohio governor a couple of times in the 1980s, where he had this big grassroots network of supporters. And they base this off of all the goodwill that Amy Acton generated among many Ohioans during the pandemic. They saw her as cool and collected and calm and reassuring. Of course, there's the flip side of that coin, which is she generated an awful lot of rancor as the face of the pandemic. And, you know, so now it's up to her now to go out and try to reestablish that. I mean, the trick for her will be not only to build on the goodwill during the pandemic, but also what she has to reestablish herself as that same kind of leader for issues that people care about now, like the price of groceries, healthcare access. And so it's not an easy task, but her task that she's taken upon herself is to go out and try to do that.
Now, Dr. Amy Acton became a calm and trusted medical expert during Governor DeWine's daily briefings. It was during a time of fear and uncertainty, lockdowns. Dr. Acton issued the stay-at-home order in March of 2020. Ohio was the first state in the U.S. to shut down schools. Here is her reassuring Ohioans in the earliest days of the pandemic.
This is no small thing that we are doing together. It is so incredibly hard to have shut down our lives the way we have. I am absolutely certain you will look back and know that you helped save each other.
So she was known as this calm, reassuring voice, someone very empathetic. Sarah, do you think that she is too kind, or at least too kind sounding, to make it in the governor's race?
I mean, that's a tough question. I don't necessarily know that that is the struggle that she faces. I think that, you know, that's one side of the coin, but you also had a lot of, well, I wouldn't say a lot, but I would say there was a minority of people who were very frustrated with the COVID lockdowns, who saw their businesses hurt during COVID, for whatever reason, felt serious frustration toward these public health orders. So, I mean, I think Jeremy touched on this. I don't know if it's her general kindness or how she is. She's going to have to define herself outside of the COVID pandemic, because mm-hmm. I don't think Ohioans want to continue talking about COVID mm-hmm. 4 years later. Like, I think that's the last thing a lot of Ohioans want to talk about. It's a period of time they probably don't want to dwell on, because it was a really dark time for people. People were getting sick. They were in hospitals. They were struggling, you know, financially. So, I mean, she obviously provided some light to a lot of Ohioans at that period of time. But of course, the flip side of that is these health orders caused a lot of anger. And I think DeWine, not just Acton, faces a lot of pushback from his own party for how he handled COVID.
And Danny, this would be her first run for political office. She toyed briefly with a U.S. Senate run, but didn't pursue it. So she's running in a state that has gone from purple to red in recent years to very red. What makes her think she can win?
Well, it does seem like she's taking a page out of some of the populist playbook that Donald Trump has used, and some of those other Republican candidates who are now winning in Eastern Ohio, places where they used to get crushed by Democrats. Talking about looking out for people who have been left behind, looking out for people who maybe homeless or struggling in some of these areas. Her own story. She can use that. She grew up. She was homeless at times when she was growing up in the Youngstown area. So being from the Youngstown area is another thing that may help her. Democrats, if they want to have a chance to win in Ohio, they probably need to pick back up some of those votes in the Youngstown area where they've been losing. They've been losing more than they have.
And we're talking about how she's a Democrat, but she's not talking about how she's a right. Democrat so far. We're identifying in headlines she's running as a Democrat. I had someone say to me that they didn't even know she was a Democrat because she worked under Governor DeWine, which is, obviously people who follow politics closely know that, but she's not so far in a way that Sherrod Brown did on his Senate campaign. She's not identifying herself as, I'm blue, I'm a Democrat, even though, of course, she is working with the parties and she's been talking with the parties. She was at the DNC when Jeremy talked to her when she was first thinking about running for governor. So,
and Jeremy, you wrote two pretty in-depth pieces about Amy Acton over the past week. So did she address how she's going to handle her critics?
She is going to say she wants to, she says she wants to talk to everyone, and she acknowledged that people were hurt during the COVID crisis about businesses, by their businesses closing. But she wants to, refocus and talk about issues that people care about now. She was light on policy proposals, but some of the issues she's touched on include healthcare access and the price of, the cost of inflation for people, things like that, homelessness, housing issues too. And I think the best case scenario for Amy Acton, if you want to lay out like what's her path to governor, if everything goes her way, well, one, in the midterms, it's the party who doesn't control the White House who benefits. And since Donald Trump's going to be in the White House, that theoretically will help Democrats. And they're looking to Richard Cordray. Her supporters are looking to Richard Cordray in 2018, who only lost by a couple of percentage points. One of the big reasons was he didn't do as well as Mike DeWine in the suburbs. And the argument is, well, Amy Acton does well among women, middle-class women. She can do much better in the suburbs, especially now that Mike DeWine, who made a point of running in the suburbs, trying to win over this demographic. And so she can do that. And all she has to do is improve a little bit on Richard Cordray. Now, the argument against that is we will be running, this election will be 8 years after Richard Cordray. A lot has changed during that time. And so the question is whether, as one Republican put it, if basically she's going to be Beto O'Rourke, who generated a lot of publicity, we got really well known, raised a ton of money, and then got his butt handed to him when he ran for governor of Texas and for U.S. Senate. So, will she be a Barack Obama or a Beto O'Rourke? We'll have to see.
I wonder if she will run a traditional political campaign. Is she going to hire the traditional, political strategists, or do you think she'll try to do it differently, like make it a different kind of campaign? If she wants to be a different kind of candidate, she can't run it traditionally.
We'll have to see. But I talked to Dick Celeste, former governor, and she said that would be the big danger for Amy Acton, is if she hires like these Washington, D.C. traditional consultants to run her campaign. And he said that if she does that, then she's basically toast.
All right. Well, we will have to see. And we'll also have to see who comes to run against her, too. Coming up, we're going to talk about a bill that was signed into law recently from the last session, the Parents' Bill of Rights. We're also going to hear about new House and Senate leadership and possible legislative changes to recreational marijuana. Lots to cover on our reporter roundtable when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jeremy Pelzer with the Cleveland.com Politics Reporter, and Danny Eldridge, a reporter for HANA News Service. So we're going to get back to the Parental Bill of Rights, which is a controversial bill from the last legislative session, but I did want to touch on it because Governor DeWine finally signed it last week. It seems like a little bit of a delay in getting him to sign it. Proponents have dubbed it the Parental Bill of Rights, and opponents have called it Ohio's version of Florida's Don't Say Gay bill. So, Sarah, there were lengthy hearings on this bill. What were some of the main arguments for and against the passage?
Sure. So it's a really... There's a lot in this bill, and of course, a big portion that was added kind of at the last minute during lame duck has to do with religious release, which is another whole portion. But on the initial bill, proponents say that it gives parents more authority over decisions about their kids' schooling, what's going on during the school day. And opponents, particularly LGBTQ advocates, they are concerned that one of the provisions, for example, is that if there are changes in a student's physical or mental health, schools have to be more active in reporting that back to parents. LGBTQ advocates are concerned that if a student, you know, comes out to a school counselor as gay, that goes straight back to the parents, and maybe the parents aren't super accepting of that. So that's kind of where this quote-unquote don't say gay portion comes in, because LGBTQ advocates are concerned about children getting outed to their parents. Another big portion, I would say, is that counselors and school professionals have expressed some concern that this bill would limit their ability to, you know, have control over how they do their job. Of course, there could be a situation where a child's getting abused at home. And, you know, proponents kind of rebuffed this idea, but counselors brought forward, you know, this idea that when you're putting the parents first and foremost, obviously not all parents are alike, and there's this chance that students who are in abusive situations who come forward about that, you know, it could cause some more issues there. So that was another argument on the opponent side.
Governor DeWine signed the bill, and here is what he said whenever he spoke about the bill.
If you're a parent, you know, you want to be informed what's going on in your child's life. Parents are the best teachers. They're the first teachers. They're the best teachers.
And Danny, as Sarah mentioned, you know, not all parents are the same. So having school counselors have to tell the parent what is going on with some students could, you know, could be detrimental. Sometimes in the school, that's where their trusted adult is in the school instead of at home. Was that addressed at all in this bill?
I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons people were against it, is that they, you know, if, you know, he's probably right that most of the time, you know, the parents, you know, will want, you know, it's probably a good thing for parents to be, you know, involved in these decisions and notified of things. But yeah, there is a small percentage of families where if the parent finds out some of these things about their child, that could cause more abuse if abuse is already occurring. Or it could cause new abuse. The arguments that opponents were making is that it makes social workers in schools have a tough enough job already, and this makes it even harder for them. And all of this mental health supports that we're providing these children now, a lot of that could be undone by some of this bill.
Is Jeremy, do you know if it's mandatory for the school counselors to report to parents, or is there a little bit of a loophole where if they fear something at home, they don't have to?
That's something I actually don't know. Yeah. Maybe one of my colleagues does, but okay. I'm not
Sarah,
quite sure.
Do you know?
I don't mm-hmm. have specific. I know that in the process of, you know, obviously this bill went through a really long legislative process. It was introduced the GA before last, didn't really move, and this bill was held up in Senate committee until literally the last day of legislative session. And some of the amendments that were made, I think, were to try and, you know, help counselors feel more comfortable with this bill. I don't think any of the opponents ever changed their tune about the bill. And there are several other provisions in there that they, you know, brought forward concern about. For example, sexuality is loosely defined in the bill. And this bill also lets parents opt their children out of any sort of sexuality content being taught in school. So that's another big provision that less school counselors in this regard, but LGBTQ advocates were really concerned about.
Well, that we'll ask that question on Wednesday, because on Wednesday's All Sides, we're going to be talking about the Parental Bill of Rights. And one of the guests on that show is the bill sponsor, DJ. Is it Swearingen?
Yes, DJ Swearingen.
I don't think I've ever had to say his name out loud before. But so we will talk about that more. You can listen Wednesday to All Sides. And OK, so the new legislative session started this past week. Matt Huffman is the new House Speaker after serving as Senate president, and he's the first one in history to do one job right after another. It's been more than 100 years since anyone has made a similar power move. So what is Matt Huffman's first act? What does he want to do first as the new House Speaker?
Well, the first thing just any incoming House Speaker will have to deal with is very likely getting started on the budget. So that's one big thing. There's going to be less, as the way Governor DeWine put it last week, it's going to be more of a, quote, normal budget, because for the past few years, Ohio, like other states, have just been flush with coronavirus relief money from the federal government. They've gotten billions of dollars, so that's allowed them to do things like expand school vouchers and put more money for schools and just pass a number of infrastructure spending bills. But now that's coming to an end, and now they're going to have a little bit of money to work with, but not a whole lot. And Huffman has been a big proponent of school vouchers and expanding them, so we'll see if he wants to do something with that. Another big thing that's probably going to come out of the gate is Senate Bill 83, or whatever the bill number is this session. Mm-hmm. It's designed to curb liberal influence on college campuses in a number of ways, and the sponsor of that bill, Jerry Serino, state senator from Lake County, has said he's going to reintroduce that. And it was it didn't pass the House last time, even though they negotiated things to take things out of it, like prohibiting faculty unions from striking, things like that. And now Jerry Serino says that he's going to come back and put all that stuff back in. And now that Matt Huffman is in control of the House, they're going to put that through fairly quickly. Overall, both Huffman and Senate President Rob McCauley, the new Senate president, said that they want to pass a number of bills fairly quickly. That's in contrast to last session, where the infighting between Matt Huffman and then-Speaker Jason Stevens led to a lot of gridlock. And actually, there was a report that they actually passed the fewest number of bills since the mid-1950s. Mm. And so both leaders now indicate, hey, that time's over. We're going to hit the gas and pass a lot of different bills. And it's still early, so we don't know exactly what the bills will be, but that's a preview of a couple of them will be.
Okay. And Danny, is there any particular bill that's coming up that someone has mentioned that you're going to be keeping a close eye on?
Well, yeah, I mean, we asked, Speaker Huffman about some of his priorities, and one of the things he mentioned right away was dealing with Delta 8 and cannabis. So I think you can expect something on cannabis. It's hard to tell exactly.
Tell our listeners what Delta 8 is. I think we know what cannabis is, but yeah.
So Delta 8 is like synthetic marijuana. It is very similar and has very similar effects as marijuana, but it's not marijuana. And it's sold in convenience stores, smoke shops, other places like that, which have obviously much less regulation than the adult use cannabis market and the medical market. So the concern with that is that it's easier for children to get access to them. Some of them are, sold in packages that look like, Fruit Loops, et cetera, like that, Mm-hmm. So it's more complicated than it seems, because these compounds, once you ban one compound, they can just change it slightly. And also there are legal and non, maybe, people would argue not harmful versions of of intoxicating hemp that could be affected, or not even intoxicating hemp. You know, some of the main opponents of the Delta 8 legislation were CBD companies and hemp farmers, who believe that the language was too broad and would, you know, affect their ability to sell CBD like, you know, people can sell across the country now with the new rules from the USDA. So anyway, it's not a simple fix, and it's something that they're going to have to, I would imagine, they're going to have to work on. They're going to have to work with all of the, you know, the stakeholders from those various industries. So I'm definitely going to be following that. And also just with cannabis in general, we know that Speaker Huffman wasn't a big fan of, you know, Issue 2. He's talked about, you know,
the voters of Ohio passed recreational marijuana, said we want it to be legal.
Right. And and they passed a bill that would have, you know, reduced some of the home grow opportunities and made some other changes. And the House didn't move on it because, Speaker Stevens didn't want to go against what the voters just did. And Representative Callender, who is a proponent of marijuana legalization, was their leader on that.
Yeah, Sarah, Governor DeWine really wanted the last General Assembly to fix all of this. Why didn't they?
Yeah, none of this is new. I mean, since marijuana went recreationally legal in 2023, I mean, the legislature's been bickering over this, and DeWine has kind of been the, like, town crier about it. I hate to describe him as that, but, like, there was a period of time where every press conference he was like, please do something with Delta 8. Please do something with marijuana. You have a lot of representatives in the House who come from districts down in Southeast Ohio or other rural parts of the state that benefit from the cannabis side and also the hemp side, because like Danny said, there's intoxicating hemp and there's non-intoxicating hemp. And that was all made legal by the federal government in 2018 under this other bill. So there's this like huge category of products that like kind of looks like marijuana, smells like marijuana, but it's like not technically legally marijuana, says the federal government. Ohio is one of the only states that hasn't handled this at all. Like, it's legal to buy at any age, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of gridlock over some lawmakers want the cannabis legislation and the Delta 8 legislation to be separate. Others, like chiefly Senate President former Senate President, now Speaker Matt Huffman, I'm going to be doing that for a couple of months.
Yeah.
And Senate President Rob McCauley, they think it should be all done together because it's this idea. It looks like marijuana. It smells not like marijuana. We should just legislate it like marijuana. So there's, I mean, a lot of arguments over the chief, like, do we pass a big bill or a small bill and another bill? And you've got a lot of interest here, too. You've got the marijuana industry that wants to snuff out the Delta 8 industry for more reasons than one. You know, marijuana dispensaries are going through all this red tape to be able to sell their product. And folks that sell Delta 8 don't have to go through any of that red tape. So you see some of that concern there, but also these products that are being sold in gas stations and I've seen dedicated Delta 8 stores that kind of operate like a dispensary that's unlicensed. Like, they sell the product, they do card people, et cetera, et cetera, and they say they're kind of the good eggs. But a lot of these gas stations, the products they're getting, it's not tested. Like, it's not going through the same regulations or regimen that cannabis is going through. So you had the cannabis industry really pushing for the Delta 8 regulations. But once you tack on the cannabis regulations and you start regulating the cannabis industry, you lose the cannabis industry. So there's a lot at play here. And I'm interested to see how it works out because, I mean, I really do think the bill that passed in 2023 that the Senate passed, I really think Huffman sees that as a really good framework, but you saw a lot of different folks who were really angry at that bill, from folks who wanted to home grow and felt like they were, you know, seeing these limits on home grow. And you've had recreational marijuana has been legal for a year now. I mean, people have been operating under these laws for a year now, and dispensaries have been selling marijuana for several months now legally. So to change it kind of midstream, I'm going to be interested to see if there's that same kind of energy. I think you're going to see a lot of people coming out in opposition.
I do want to just say one thing, because when we were talking, it was interesting. We were talking to Speaker Huffman, you know, after he became Speaker, and when he was talking about this, he did say, a lot of people are talking about the home grow, and I don't really see that as that big of a deal, which is news to me for him. Because it seemed like a pretty big deal to him, you know, not that long ago. So I don't know if that's him
Maybe,
you know,
he
conceding
has,
that issue.
It was a big
for,
deal
for
him
one?
as a senator. Well, but now as a
I don't know. So I guess it's just something to watch. I'm not sure if that means, you know, he's going to lay off the home grow and go after some of the other
I
stuff.
I wonder if he means, though, that he doesn't see it as a big deal because the industry doesn't see it as a big deal. Because you've got, again, a different interest there. People who are growing their own marijuana are not going to dispensaries for the most part to buy products. They're buying the seeds, but then they're growing it themselves.
Well, and Sarah, you mentioned the red tape. And I mean, I have to imagine that whatever this bill is going to be just a mess for the Department of Commerce. Is that who regulates this? I mean, everything could change or...
Yeah, the Department of Commerce is going to have to stomach that, because I know Danny mentioned Representative Jamie Callender. He's a huge advocate for marijuana legalization and has shaped a lot of the marijuana policy at the State House. He was really advocating for just let the Department of Commerce regulate this stuff. Mm-hmm. And if they need legislative changes, they'll come to us. But if you're passing all this legislation, the Department of Commerce is going to have to make changes in how they do things as well. I mean, of course, with the tax structure and all of that.
It sounds like the Department of Commerce is going to need more money if they have to go visit every gas station to check on what they're selling, right?
Well, I will say, though, the Ohio Department of Agriculture regulates hemp. So,
But one of the bills moved it under Department of Commerce, I will
right.
say. So who knows?
That could change. But currently, and they don't do a whole, I mean, I'm not saying that they're not doing their job, but they do. They're still not like a whole lot of regulation of CBD products necessarily, but they are the ones who do the oversight right currently. But Commerce does do all of the cannabis medical and adult use now.
All right. Well, I don't think we solved anything here, but we'll have to see what happens. This is the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and we'll be back in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And still with us is Danny Eldridge, reporter for Hanna News Service, Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And another priority is revamping the state's energy policy. Details are still coming together, but what is the latest thinking about what the state needs to do when it comes to energy policy?
It's tough to say. There's a lot of interests here. And I will say that I think Senate President Rob McCauley is going to be someone who's going to be heralding a lot of this. There were several energy-related bills that kind of got axed right at the end of lame duck. One of those was a quote-unquote energy efficiency bill that would have restored some of what was axed in House Bill 6, but it would have allowed people to... You're automatically opted in. You'd have to opt out of these energy efficiency programs that different energy companies could create, and it would be like an extra dollar on your bill. So there was a lot of opposition to that because there was this automatic charge that you had to opt out of. But, I mean, lawmakers have expressed to me that they're concerned about the state of energy in Ohio. You've got these data centers flocking to Ohio who are just eating up energy needs. There's this concern of high costs, of potential rolling brownouts in the future. So I know they want to do something, but I think it remains to be seen what gets done. And I think, you know, like I said, Senate President Rob McCauley is definitely going to be heralding some of this.
And Central Ohio continues to land more and more of these data centers. There's 170 of them in total, fourth most in the country. Ohio has worked hard to attract these facilities, offering tax breaks and other incentives. Are we going to just keep building them, Jeremy?
Right now, it looks like we are. And what this is going to do, these data centers, some of them are for AI, for a number of different things, but they consume enormous amounts of power. So right now, Central Ohio, their peak power demands about 4,000 megawatts. And these data centers would add 5,000 megawatts to the grid. And developers actually said this could go up to 30,000 megawatts. So this is an enormous amount of power that these data centers take. And they don't just take power, they take water. Mm-hmm. They need an enormous amount of water as well. So the question is, as these data centers are built, what are they going to do to the power supply? And not just physically being able to get the power to them, who's going to pay for the infrastructure to get the power to them, this enormous amount of power? And what is that going to do to utility bills? I mean, if just basic capitalism is, if you have an increased demand, it's going to lead to higher prices. How are consumers, like residential consumers, going to be protected as all these data centers suck up all these enormous amounts of power?
Is this something the state lawmakers have to handle, or like, because a lot of local communities are bearing the brunt of this right now?
It's a combination. It's not going to be. I mean, you see some lawmakers kind of taking this on because so far the state has offered serious tax incentives for these data centers to build here, and there's a real difference between something like a data center and something like an Intel. Of course, there have been concerns about the Intel project out in Licking County, but that project is projected to create all these jobs. Data centers do not create jobs. They're getting huge tax breaks to maybe hire like 20 full-time employees.
This is a huge building with few people.
Yeah, and so, you know, local governments are also offering tax abatements and all these different incentives. Policy Matters, a left-leaning research group, I talked with them last week because they are really concerned about this sales tax exemption that the state is offering these data centers to come in. I mean, some of these benefits could reach 30 years from now to build here. And I talked to one lawmaker, Senator Bill Blessing. He's a Republican. He introduced a bill last year to get rid of those sales tax exemptions for data centers. He says he wants to reintroduce it this year. So some of it is going to be, I mean, does the state need to look at reining in some of these incentives for data centers? Because there have been folks who work in the tech industry who say it's not even the incentives that are drawing us to one place or the other. It's the land and it's the natural resources that, you know, if it makes sense to build here or to build here. It's not just the tax incentives.
Yeah, I was going to ask, why Ohio?
So one part that lawmakers have indicated they do want to tap into is Ohio has a whole lot of natural gas. And over the past decade or two, there's been a big move as natural gas prices have fallen to increasingly have power plants that use natural gas instead of, say, coal. Mm-hmm. And so while it's still vague, as Sarah said, Rob McCauley said there's going to be some sort of initiative to harness that natural gas potential, which means fracking and drilling in eastern Ohio and building the pipelines and infrastructure and power plants needed to actually use that natural gas.
And allowing the fracking in state parks, that was a first step toward this, yes.
And I should mention, too, it's obviously not going to just be the lawmakers like we were talking about. I think a big question in front of the PUCO, which is the committee that regulates all these utility companies, there's a big question right now in front of them about how do we kind of quote unquote hold, I don't want to say, I mean, this is my words, but hold these data centers' feet to the fire for the energy that they consume. So AEP has proposed this tariff on them that they've got to pay for a certain amount of energy that they say they'll use so that it doesn't fall on the backs of residential consumers. And I think even Walmart has signed on to that tariff proposal. So that's being debated in front of the PUCO and has been debated for a while. On the flip side, the folks who lobby for the data centers say you're kind of singling out one kind of customer. You wouldn't do this for other customers. So there's a big debate right now about how to ensure that these data centers are paying for, like Jeremy said, not just the energy they're using, but the infrastructure that's needed to actually get them the energy.
All right. Well, pivoting to another topic, Danny, you wrote about sports betting operations, right? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. So sports betting operations have had a particularly strong month, reporting the largest monthly revenue totals since sports gambling launched in January of 2023. So what do you know about who's betting and who's prospering from all of this?
Well, I mean, the main companies that are prospering are FanDuel and DraftKings. I mean, those are the leaders in Ohio. Those are the leaders nationally as well. It's pretty much those two, and then everyone else. Although, I mean, but there are others that have been grown. I mean, Bet365 has also grown significantly in Ohio. Their revenue is way up. I mean, way up from a year ago.
We're 2 years into legal sports betting. So, has Ohio benefited, or are we hurting from this?
I guess it depends on who you ask. I mean, yeah. There are some people who don't like gambling, obviously. For them to get about as high as they were the month that they launched is actually surprising to me, because they got over a billion in handle in November, this past November, and that's obviously the highest as well since January, when it was new, when they were giving out all those bonus bets, all the mm-hmm. promotions. So now there's still some promotions, but they're not like the crazy ones where you get put in $5 and get $200 in bonus bets anymore. It does seem like they're getting good growth and people who are consistently playing.
I bet there's going to be a few bets this week.
Well, yeah, I think, Ohio State, obviously, and Ohio State being good will probably help the sports gambling industry in Ohio.
And like with any new industry, you're going to have, hiccups, bumps in the road, whatever euphemism you want to use. Like, for example, recently gambling regulators hit DraftKings with a $425,000 fine because they inappropriately allowed residents to bet on individual college athletes' performances, which Ohio doesn't allow because they're worried that bettors who lost money will go to these athletes and say, "Hey, you lost me all this money."
Huh.
And also, there's this whole issue too of how people can deposit money in their accounts. There's a number of times there are people who go down to their local drugstore and hand cash to the person behind the counter, and that person behind the counter then routes it through a third party, like a third party company, to put the money in the account. That's not allowed right now under Ohio, or at least it's not banned. It's one of those things where it's not allowed, so therefore you can't do it. So that's not like there's these little tweaks that Ohio gambling regulators now have to make to this, because we've only been allowed to bet on sports gambling for a little more than a year. So we're working out the kinks in the armor right now. So,
and Sarah, we're down to about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to talk to you. You reported on a coalition of businesses and community organizations that want to see housing as a bigger legislative priority. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was led by the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, Habitat for Humanity of Ohio, several homeless coalitions. I think the list of the people behind this proposal is about 20 organizations, or maybe even two dozen. They just want to see housing in general as a bigger priority. One of the chief things is, of course, reining in property taxes, finding ways to offer Ohioans relief. I know one of the things that the Chamber of Commerce is pushing for is, offering incentives to local communities for retooling their zoning codes to make sure that their zoning codes are more friendly to housing. Because right now there are some zoning codes, the Chamber of Commerce tells me, that, have the ability to either limit housing developments, price people out of their neighborhoods. So that's another one. But there's a full, 11-point proposal that they're putting out about housing policy. And really, last GA, there was a housing committee. They released their policy priorities, the legislature did, and nothing got done. So it'll be interesting to see if this becomes a bigger priority this year.
That was my next question. Are lawmakers going to do anything?
I mean, that's always the question.
Does Matt Huffman want to do anything?
Matt Huffman was there when the Housing Committee released its findings, and I know that Senator Michelle Reynolds, she's, been a pretty vocal voice for some of these housing policies. She's a Republican, so we'll see, what gets introduced and what gets moved this year. But I definitely could see, if the chambers are working together a little bit more, some of this you know, potential more bipartisan legislation moving.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. There's plenty more to talk about, but thank you so much for joining me. This has been the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. Sarah Donaldson, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter, Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks.
And also reporter for Hannah News Service, Danny Eldridge. Thank you, Danny.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.